Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Stanley is a man of many musical talents. He's a DJ, a producer, a composer, a journalist, a film producer, and a living compendium of pop music culture, all of which alongside his role as one of the masterminds behind Saint Etienne. He's also an utterly delightful chap. So for all those reasons, he is my guest this week on The First Time. The first question we always ask everybody is, when were they first aware of music, normally like as a young child? When does it start for you?
I think the first time I was aware of music was just... my dad was a big hi-fi buff, and I just remember being obsessed with like flicking through his records. There's a lot of classical stuff, not that much pop, and just the act of him putting a record on, normally on a Sunday, he didn't really put records on in the week. Which just really fascinated me, and the records he used to play were like Simon & Garfunkel, Neil Diamond. He had a single of FBI by The Shadows. I was allowed to play with that. I was allowed to play with the old singles.
At that early age, they felt special. These pieces of music felt special in your household.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just fascinated by the labels, and I couldn't read, so I didn't know what they said. But just having like a white label with a big red A on it looked really exciting to me. And then when I could read, it didn't make much more sense. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of sort of heavy orchestral stuff played in the house, Mahler and Wagner.
Can you remember the first song that made an impact on you enough to kind of, you know, you play it and you play it again and then you play it again and you play it again?
I think the first record I played a lot was the Persuaders theme, which sounds like a fib, but it isn't. I got it in jumble sale when I was about 9 or 10. But the programme used to be on Sunday afternoon when I was a kid, and it was had the big match was on afterwards, so that was like, that was Sunday, and my dad playing his classical records. And I didn't have many records, so I remember playing that a lot. Friends with Pete Wiggs when we were very small. He used to come round and ask me to play Sugar Sugar, which I also had. We used to play that a lot as well. And my sister used to get me to sing Long Haired Lover from Liverpool, which is not quite as cool.
About the first single that you went out and bought specifically for you, you remember kind of seeing on TV or hearing on the radio and going, "That's I must possess that."
It was Amasra by Sparks, which again sounds like a fib.
The first record. These are all very, very significant, cool, brilliant bits of music you're choosing.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it wasn't the first record I owned, which was Ernie by Benny Hill, but it was the first record I went to Woolies and asked my mum if she could buy it for me.
So tell me about owning that first piece of vinyl.
It was in Woolworths in Red Hill, and I didn't go and buy it myself. My mum got it for me, and she asked me if I wanted a record. I'd have missed This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, which is a better record, I think. And it came in a pink Island bag, I remember taking it home and having to get my dad to play it on the hi-fi because I didn't have a record player at that point.
At what point did this idea of loving music start to translate into maybe, well, this is something that I want to be involved with, past just this kind of passive experience? Maybe I want to write about it, I want to play it, or I want to go and see it. When did that start?
I think when I started buying albums a bit later, and I used to read the sleeve notes and, like, you know, memorise the sleeve notes on a lot of compilations, and that's how I picked up on a lot of sort of musical history, I suppose. So I used to do my own sleeve notes to my own compilations, and obviously not show them to anyone. So I thought possibly I could be a writer. I never ever thought I'd be a musician or in a group, because I didn't have the patience, really. I started learning to play guitar at one point, clarinet at one point, bought a Korg MS-10 when I was about 15.
It's pretty cool,
but couldn't get much out of it.
You mentioned albums. What was the what early albums would we find you playing if we went back to your household in the 70s?
It would have been mostly sort of greatest hits things. Beach Boys' 20 Golden Greats, which was, I think, was like a best-selling album that year. Golden Hour of the Kinks, like a budget compilation. It was just before punk, and I didn't really buy that many new records, because, you know, 1975-76, the charts were full of Pussycat and, you know, ABBA. I liked ABBA, but I didn't own any of the records. And a Hot Butter album, the second Hot Butter album, which was the first record I ever bought, which didn't even have popcorn on it.
I didn't even have the one track that they're famous for on.
No, it just had lots of sort of dodgy covers of Pipeline and Tequila and things like that. But
done in that unique, strange, odd little monotone keyboard sound.
Yeah, it's really sort of bubbly Moog sound, which doesn't sound too good now.
Beach Boys, I presume they made quite a big impact on you. Music is obviously one of the big sort of touchstones. What was it about them that kind of appealed? Was it the otherworldliness, this beautiful California thing, or this incredible production?
It's, I suppose it was a production, but I mean, I wouldn't have known what a production was. I mean, I think when you're a kid and you hear music, you don't really have any grasp on what the instruments are. It's just a sound that excites you, like, you know, whether it was a Moog or production on God Only Knows. But I remember it was like the 20 Golden Greats album was album of the week on Noel Edmonds' breakfast show, and I'd never heard, so every morning I was hearing something like God Only Knows or Sloop John B or Good Vibrations for the first time, and just thought, you know, it's in the middle of 1976, it just sounded unbelievable. And yeah, I think it's the richness, and even now I haven't got a clue what a lot of the instrumentation is on Pet Sounds, for instance. Though life would still go on, believe me, the world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
So your first kind of job in music, what would that be? Would that have been, I say job, I mean, you know, step towards a career. Would it have been as a fanzine writer? Would that have been the very first kind of you being involved in music rather than music just coming to you?
Yeah, I moved to Peterborough with my parents in the mid-80s. And I come from Croydon, which isn't the most exciting town in the world, but Peterborough is a lot less exciting. And I just started hanging out with this gang of blokes in a pub, the five interesting people in the town. And they'd been talking about doing a fanzine for ages. And I think when I came along and we started talking about it, going, okay, well, we're really going to do it this time. So we did one called Pop Avalanche, which was very mid-80s. It had, like, the Pastels in it and Primal Scream. And from that, I did one with Pete, who was still living in Croydon, called Calf. And I sent that off to James Brown at NME, and he said, do you want to go and review Johnny Cash in Peterborough next week? So I was like, okay. And it was that easy.
You got to see Johnny Cash play in Peterborough. What was that gig like as your first proper professional paid muso gig?
It's I wasn't blown away, really. It wasn't the greatest period. It's like 1987.
Oh, dear.
and it was a lot of him and June Carter doing quite sort of hokey country stuff. But obviously he sang Folsom Prison Blues and things. I Walked the Line, they were really good. But it was in a big sort of like, I can't think what the place is called, like the showground. It was like a, it was basically like a place we used to get cattle, and it was a big open space. And
which sounds
not very atmospheric.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right. Because you're mine, I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side.
But back on the fanzine, who are your kind of your big musical obsessions? Who are the artists that you really wanted to push, that you saw as a journalist? Because every journalist has bands that are very close to their hearts.
I think, well, when I was writing the fanzine, I was still wanting to write about a lot of old stuff. So I think I had John Barry and Age of Chance in the same fanzine, which is quite odd. But I think by the time I got to NME, I was writing about a lot of indie stuff, really. The first lucky break I got as a journalist was to go and see the Stone Roses at Middlesex Poly in early 89, because my girlfriend at the time liked Sally Cinnamon, so we should go and see them. There was about 20 people there, and obviously they came on and did the album, and it's like, God, that was impressive. So, you know, I went back. I was at Melody Maker by then. I was like, went back raving about it and did this live review. So I was like the first person at Melody Maker, anyway, to write about them, and that was a good break.
Until Sally, I was never happy. I needed so much more. Red clouds, oh, they used to chase me. Down they would fall. Join my tears.
That was pretty great. I think I went to see him in Blackpool, which was filmed, I think, came out on video at the time. But it was just incredible to see 6,000 people at that point. Coming out of the 80s, when most of the bands I was going to see were at the Falcon in Camden or Black Horse, and there's like 30 people there, to go and see a band with 8,000 people who are basically, you know, an offshoot of like what had been going on, like Primal Scream especially, I suppose they were influenced by. It was phenomenal. It was really exciting. Everybody was in a good mood.
You are my world.
ran a label for a while as well, didn't you? Is that right?
Yeah, I've run a couple. I ran one in the 80s called CAF, which was... after the fanzine. I just used to interview people when I was an enemy and melody maker and say, oh, have you got any spare songs you don't want that I can stick out on a single? So I got to do quite a few good ones. There's a Mannix one, Pulp one.
What was the first one you released?
The first one was the Field Mice.
Which track?
I Can See Myself Alone Forever, it was called. Now and then it occurs to me how I am still on my own. Now and then it occurs to me how I am still on my own.
And you didn't feel that your future belonged as a record label mogul?
It was really a hobby. I think I was aware that I could lose a lot of money running a record label, so I just did pressed 500 copies of each record, and they normally sold out pretty quick. And then me and Pete did run a label in the early 90s called Ice Rink, which did lose us a lot of money, so I didn't learn my lesson.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
5, 4.
You mentioned Pete Wiggs, so I suppose as one of the key figures in your life, we should kind of document that meeting. You said you met when you were very, very young.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we were little kids. There's a photo of us in my back garden. It's the summer, I'm wearing shorts, so I'm wearing wellies as well, and he's sitting in my pedal car. And it must be 1967, which is terrifying, because my sister's very young, so it must be summer of 67. But yeah, we went to school together, and we worked in the market in Croydon together, selling eggs and ham. Which was interesting. Mouldy eggs. I was worried that someone's going to come up to me who had a relative with salmonella from the 80s, and it'll be my fault.
So did the pair of you kind of plot and hatch the idea of eventually forming your own band?
Yeah, we both got into Street Sounds electro albums, I suppose, is what started it in about 83, 84, and things on Tommy Boy and Afrika Bambaataa records. And it's such an exciting new sound, and it was all electronic, which is very appealing. And then when Bomb the Bass and S Express came out 3 or 4 years later, and they were just doing basically the same thing themselves with equipment at home, we just thought, well, you know, we could have a go at doing this. And I knew Richard Norris from a 60s reissue label at the time called Bam Caruso, and he had a Roland bass line to make an acid house record with, so we had a go at that. And it wasn't very good. And then the second time I went to the studio, we did Only Love Can Break Your Heart, which was, again, only took about 2 hours, but that went down a bit better.
We have to talk about that track, 1990. It came out, Neil Young cover, an unusual Neil Young cover. Have you always had the love for Neil?
At that point, it was pretty new. I wasn't really aware of what he'd done until the late 80s, I think, when, like, Dinosaur Jr. came out and he started getting referenced a bit. All I knew was Heart of Gold, and after the Gold Rush, and sort of a bit drippy. I hadn't really sort of dug any deeper, and obviously, the, you know, when I heard Zuma and the first album especially, I really love, I was really blown away and played them all the time.
When you were young and on your own, how did it feel to be alone? I was always thinking of games that I was playing, trying to make the best of my time, but only love can break your heart. Try to be sure right from the start. Yes, only love can break your heart. What if your world should fall apart?
Track you say took a couple of hours?
Yeah, that's all we could afford at the time.
What do you remember about the session?
It was midweek and it was an evening, and I think Ian Capp, the engineer, he worked with the Fieldmaster, which is how we met him, and we still work with him now. It was the end of the day, and I remember he didn't, I think we went and got some chips because we were hungry. He wasn't very happy about that, because in my studio I smell of chips. That's the strongest memory of it, really. There's a girl called Moira Lambert who's in a band called Faith Over Reason, and she sang it. Because we weren't a band, we didn't have a singer, we hadn't met Sarah at that point. It was just recording something as quickly as we could.
Because it made quite a sizable impact, didn't it?
Yeah, we were very lucky. Jeff Barrett was just starting Heavenly. I knew him from putting on gigs, but he'd had a couple of labels before that, but it was like Heavenly was just about to start and he got like a distribution deal. And I played it to him just to see what he thought of it, and he said, oh, I really like this, can I put it out? So we were like, yeah, great. Just absolutely never thought we'd get to make a record.
So then you kind of have to put a band, you have to kind of make the band, not official, but kind of form a group around that, I suppose, and you have to get a regular singer. When did you first meet Sarah Cracknell, who became your singer?
We met Sarah when she was a friend of my girlfriend's. She was from Windsor. She just invited us around for dinner. We heard a record that she'd done with Sidecut DB, a friend of hers called Douglas Benford, which was really nice. She obviously had a very distinctive voice and thought that would really suit Nothing Can Stop Us, which we'd just written. And we went round to her house and she made us a salad and we got on really well. And yeah, that was it, really. Before that, we thought we were going to be like Soul to Soul and have a different singer on each record, which is, yeah,
too much effort.
Sounds funny now, but yeah, it's obviously much easier, much more fun when you've got like a regular lineup.
What were your kind of touchstones for making that record then? What music were you listening to? What kind of sounds were you trying to recreate or channel?
What was I listening to? A lot of Italian house. I mean, it's obviously quite slow. Soul to Soul, I was very into. I think when we did Fox Bass Alpha, when we started recording, writing our own songs immediately after Ain't Love Can Break Your Heart, we were really trying to throw everything in that we were into, which was things with feedback, psychedelic stuff, a lot of dance music, a lot of early house. And it sounds like a mishmash to me, that album, but people seem to really like it. I think Only Life Can Break Your Heart was somewhere where that did all actually fit together pretty well.
BBC Six Music.
One of our smash hits, Bad Photographer.
Welcome Welcome back, and you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Bob Stanley from St Etienne. One of the things that the band became associated with is the kind of 60s aesthetic in terms of the production and stuff, and Joe Meek is someone that you've mentioned was a big influence. When did you start to kind of investigate his production and kind of think, well, there's some elements of this that I find really interesting?
He was someone I've been aware of from being a kid and hearing Telstar. When me and Pete got a flat together, I really wanted to live near Holloway Road because I was fairly obsessed with Joe Meek at this point. Live near the studio and hope that would rub off a bit.
So you actually live somewhere near where he lives to kind of intentionally?
Yeah. Tufnell Park.
What are the classic Meek tracks for you then?
There's a Honeycomb song called Eyes, which is about their fourth or fifth single, and it wasn't a hit. And it's just really, really strangely produced. It's not one of his, like, Everything But The Kitchen Sink productions. It's very minimal. And it sounds like he's basically stripped out the original melody and just left these weird harmonies in on the vocal and the guitar part. It's really creepy, and that's the kind of thing that I'm always trying to sort of like record stuff that's quite minimal but really effective, and it's very hard, but that's a good example.
Eyes I've seen in some crowded places, staring from lonely faces, wanting someone to want them to. Eyes that night after night are trying to keep themselves from crying, making believe their dreams are true. But eyes of someone losing love, who would ever have thought that I'd find them there? Eyes that watched as we drew together, wondering if we could ever find all the love they had never.
never find us where people go, 'cause they're alone. Now I gaze in the eyes of the one I love. Now no longer alone and afraid and sad.
As the success of the band grew, there was opportunities for remixes and collaborating with other people. Who was the first kind of hero of yours you got to actually work with?
Andy Weatherall at the time offered to do Only Love Can Break Your Heart, which was really exciting. He was a great DJ and was making... Well, he'd done Loaded, was the first record he'd made at that point. It was just very exciting to be sort of like, you know, in the same room as a lot of these people. Of the remixers who did our stuff, Aphex Twin was fantastic. I remember, like, going to a firework display on Highbury Fields with him the day he was... we gave him the tape to do a mix of Who Do You Think You Are.
He's on the Phone was one of your big hits, a sizable smash, I think, would be a good word to say, 1995, collaboration with Etienne Daho. How did you meet him? How did you first come into contact with
him? He came to see us when we played in Paris, and I think from a French exchange partner years before, I sort of knew he was a big star in France. I wasn't really that aware of his stuff. And he just said, would you like to do a record with us? And we thought, well, yeah, I mean, it's... It will sell a lot of copies in France, being quite cynical. But when we got to know him better, he was a massive Françoise Hardy fan, which I am as well. And he'd written a book on her and knew her. He knew everyone. He knew Sylvie Vartan. He knew every sort of like major French pop star. So and he's a lovely, lovely man. And he invited us to stay at his house a few times. So, yeah, we got to know him pretty well.
He's on the phone and she wants to go home. Shoes in hand, don't make a sound, it's time to go.
Françoise Hardy, tell me about that. Has there always been this the lure of the kind of exotic French artist in your kind of music taste?
It's yes, probably. I think it's just the exotic. I think. I never went abroad till I was 15, so France did seem very exotic. It doesn't seem so much now, I suppose, to a lot of people. And also, a lot of those French 60s records were pretty unknown in the 90s. We were going to France a fair bit then, and I'd pick up records by France Gall and Jacques Dutronc and Michel Polnareff, and I'd never heard any of them. And it was like a parallel universe. It's like the sort of 60s and 70s through this odd prism, because the records do sound distinctly French, even though they're trying to sound British or American a lot of the time. So I love that. The sort of the slight otherness. It's not, you know, it's not Captain Beefheart. It's just like it's the Beatles, but with this sort of very odd twist to it.
Name a track that we could play from that genre.
There's a song by Michel Polnareff called Le Roi de For Me, which Jarvis did a cover of, or Pulp did a cover of, at some point in the 90s. It means the King of the Ants. It's very good.
Je suis roi de For Me, mis dans
When did you start getting involved in soundtracks? Because this is something that kind of has infused your kind of recent history, is working on film scores and stuff like that. When did you first start getting involved in that?
We did a soundtrack for a film called The Misadventures of Margaret in the mid-90s, which was sort of a cross between Carry On and Woody Allen, sort of a British-American film, which nobody saw. And that was the first soundtrack we did, and it was pretty hard work. And I think after that we thought, well, we'd love to do more soundtracks. Might be easier if we do soundtracks to our own films. So when we did Finisterre in 2002, Paul Kelly, who made most of our videos, we talked to him about doing a film to go with the whole album, or a film for each song, anyway. And it ended up becoming this completely independent film called Finisterre. And from that point on, we kept working together and making films. We did one about the Lee Valley, the Olympic site, just before it all got redeveloped. And one about the Festival Hall, history of the Festival Hall.
Talking about soundtracks, John Barry is someone that we talked about right at the very start of the chat. What is it about the late, great John Barry that kind of inspires you so much?
I think it's mostly atmosphere. He gets an incredible atmosphere from just a long string drone. Again, exotic instrumentation, cymbalom, I think he pretty much brought over here, which is the thing on the Persuaders and the Ipcris file. It's Hungarian, I think.
Right.
It wasn't a pop instrument before, but, you know, with Portishead and whatever, it's become one since. And it's quite easy to sample now. Yeah, his music sounds very English while sounding exotic, and it's very, very atmospheric. I mean, a soundtrack like The Chase, which was set in the Deep South in 1965, the film's from. It's not a great film, but it's an incredibly atmospheric soundtrack. The main theme is... just sounds like a sunrise somewhere in the south, rickety old wooden buildings.
Because you DJ a lot as well, in terms of asking you a first. What's your favourite first track to open a DJ set with? This is always not about the last song, it's about the first song.
I normally play something I've just bought that I'm sort of like trying out to see how it goes down. I really like to play sort of slower things that you can't dance to quite a lot. I'm really into a lot of early 60s, like early soul at the moment, which you can dance to, but people at the moment seem to want really frantic, like very fast Motown. That seems to be what sort of 60s clubs anyway. That seems to be what people want.
So what sort of thing you find gets people in the right place?
There's a record called Certain Things by Billy Fury, which I play, which I don't think anybody else does. I can sort of lay claim to that one, which is pretty irresistible.
What's coming up for you with Saint Etienne World next?
We're doing a new album at the moment, which is like the first one for a few years. We all live in different towns now, so we don't get together as often as we'd like to.
But the band never seemed to split. It kind of seems to just be this ongoing concern that will kind of surface and then sort of duck under the waves again.
Yeah, I mean, we've been making the films, doing the soundtracks to the films together, and still doing Christmas shows, and we never split. It just seems to have taken a long time to get around to doing another album.
How's it sounding?
It's sounding really good. It's very up-tempo, but hopefully it'll be out, hopefully in September, and if we get it done quick enough, otherwise beginning of next year.
And some reissues as well?
All our catalogues come out as double CDs now. Sarah's solo album is still to come out, and Casino Classics, which is the remix album, that's going to come out in the summer, I think.
We've had all these firsts throughout your career. We now finish with the last. You get to pick the last song as well. It can be anything you want. It can be something significant of yours, or something about an artist you admire, past, present, or possibly even future.
First thing comes to mind called It's Rough Out There by Jerry Jackson, which is the kind of record I like to play when I'm DJing, but it's too slow to dance to.
What is it about that track?
It's very atmospheric again, beautiful arrangement, pizzicato strings, really strong vocal, very intense.
So you wanna leave my arms, my warm and loving arms. So you really want to go, leave the one who needs you so. Well, I got to warn you, baby, it's only fair. It's rough out there, rough out there. You got to believe me, baby, it's rough out there. I love, and I wanna keep you warm, keep you out of the storm. Missing fun, and now you wanna run. So you think we don't belong, baby, baby, you're so wrong. Now why can't you see the road sign? It says beware.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
I was kissing. This is BBC Radio
6 Music.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.